This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
WNYC Studios is supported by W.W. Norton & Company, publishers of The Road to Freedom, Economics and the Good Society, by Nobel Prize-winning economist Joseph E. Stiglitz. The Road to Freedom, essential reading for those committed to the American ideal of an economic and political system that delivers well-being, opportunity, and meaningful freedoms for all. The Road to Freedom, available now wherever books are sold.
Listener supported, WNYC Studios.
Observatory, straight of the block to West Boulevard and make that right.
They didn't break that, but they are, have pretty good access to those people.
He subconsciously mocks that lineage.
So that's happening. Okay.
It seems like an incredible story here on many fronts.
From One World Trade Center in Manhattan, this is the New Yorker Radio Hour, a co-production of WNYC Studios and the New Yorker.
11!
Congratulations on a spectacular bit of diplomacy.
Welcome to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. Today we're going to drop in as a group of British officials tries to figure out how to contain the threat of Russia, calling on an unusual means, a game.
Theresa May now has two choices. She's either strong enough to take Brexit forward.
It's a strategic board game that's something like a cross between Dungeons and Dragons and Risk, and it's played by generals, policy experts, and diplomats. That's up later. Now, the threat of Russia is one thing, but here in the United States, we don't even understand the damage Russia has already done to our democratic processes. And even to ask about Russian meddling, unfortunately, is seen as a partisan move. The president denounces the Mueller investigation as if it were some sort of devious cover-up for Hillary Clinton's email troubles. And the House Intelligence Committee just concluded its investigation with bitter disputes between the Republicans and the Democratic minority. But in the Senate, on the Intelligence Committee, members are working very hard to maintain at least a functioning bipartisan investigation. The committee's vice chairman is Mark Warner, Democratic senator from Virginia. Few people in Washington are more up to speed than Warner on Russian exploitation of social media and the possibility, at least, of collusion by the Trump campaign. I reached Warner last week at the Capitol. What's been the most eye-opening part of the investigation so far? You've said that this is the most important thing possibly that you'll ever do in your public life. You still feel that way?
I do, David. I feel like maybe the most remarkable thing is how comprehensive the Russian effort was and how off guard in many ways the American government, the American electoral system, our social media companies, we were just not prepared. And a year and a half after the election, I worry that we're still not fully prepared in terms of election security. We still haven't sorted out a new set of rules, regulations, or frankly, frame around social media. And the vulnerabilities we have in cybersecurity are still enormous. And thing we have determined, the three things that there is broad bipartisan agreement on, at least in the Senate, is, you know, Russians massively intervened in our elections. They did it to try to help Trump and hurt Clinton. They ended up then touching at least, if not breaking into, 21 of our state's electoral systems. And they also used social media in ways that were unprecedented to try to build active groups of followers to stir dissension and dissent. And in all three of these areas, they've not stopped. And matter of fact, if you look at what they've been doing not only in America but France, the UK, elsewhere, and you add up all the cost of the Russian expenditures in the French elections, our elections, and the Brexit vote, it's less than the cost of one new F-35 airplane. So I feel like they're getting a pretty good bang for the buck or bang for the ruble on this kind of active measures.
Now, there are a couple of ways to look at the collusion question. One of them is just to think in terms of people on the Trump side being schnooks, being inexperienced and too eager to hear bad things about Hillary Clinton. That's one very highly sympathetic way to do it. The other one suggests something so colossally awful that it beggars the imagination, or it goes far beyond any spy novel we've read, which is the idea that the Trump campaign knowingly, and with some intelligence and foresight, cooperating with the Russian government. Do you still think that latter is possible?
David, I'm reserving my final judgment until we've seen all the witnesses we need to see and that we've gotten all the facts. So I'm gonna hold off. I've been under enormous pressure for the last year for some folks who say, hey, shut it down. There's no there there. A la Mr. Trump. There's others who want to try to say, oh, Trump is guilty from day one. I'm not gonna weigh in until we've seen everyone. One of the things that has surprised me, though, is that here we are, spring of 2018, and in many ways we have at least more lines of inquiry in terms of outreach from Russians or folks that have mysterious background to individuals in the Trump orbit than we did, say, a year ago. Now, again, this may all be simply a set of coincidences, or it may be, as you said, there was not the sophistication to realize what was happening. But the fact is, Mueller has gotten, 2 or 3 guilty pleas already, and 20-plus indictments, counting a number of Russians in that category who have been using tools like social media and others to intervene in our elections. So there's a lot of material there that our legal justice system has to weigh through. And
are you still getting new documents and evidence?
We are still receiving additional information. We still have got ongoing challenges, for example, with the Trump transition, where they claim a so-called executive privilege that we can't find any reputable lawyer that thinks they've got any validity. But we are still getting some documents there. We're still getting some documents connected with certain individuals who've popped up during the course of the campaign. So yes, I mean, I'm anxious for this to come to a conclusion, but we owe the American public the full truth.
Can you put a timeline on your work?
I'm not going to put a timeline, but I'm hopeful that every 30 to 45 days we'll be able to put out additional sections of the report. As I said, we've got the first section, the election security, where we've come out with bipartisan legislation, where we got $380 million to beef up election security in this past budget. This was a normal administration. You'd have a White House task force on election security. So instead, we've been trying to push it bipartisan from the Hill. We'll have that first product out in the next week or so.
Can you get interest or cooperation from the White House on at least protecting future elections?
Well, there is, David, where it's that's where we get so darn frustrated. You know, Department of Homeland Security acknowledges that the Russians will be back. Dan Coats, our former colleague, Director of National Intelligence, has acknowledged publicly the Russians will be back and are still back in terms of using social media right now on a host of issues. We had the head of the NSA. All of Mr. Trump's appointees acknowledge this. Yet, and this is their public testimony, they have said none of them have received directions from the White House to make this a priority going forward.
Now, the standard analysis of Putin's motivation is that he really couldn't stand Hillary Clinton. He saw Bill Clinton as the man who helped expand NATO, and he saw Hillary Clinton as the Secretary of State encouraging anti-Putin, anti-regime protests, and so on. But what could possibly be the motivation to want to have Donald Trump president, the master of chaos? Russians are anti-chaos. That's certainly characteristic of Putin, anti-chaos, anti-revolutionary. Why want Donald Trump as president of the United States?
Well, I think there are some people that have made guesses in that area, and I'm not going to get into questions around finances or others that certain people have asserted. But I would also
suggesting that he might be beholden to Russia.
There are press stories on those accounts, but again, I'm not validating or invalidating anything until we're finished with the investigation. But there's obviously been press speculation. But the thing I would might disagree with you on your premise is, I don't think the Russians were necessarily pro one party or another by any means, but they see that chaos in the West is good for Putin, both in terms of reasserting Russia's ascension and also pointing out to his own people, look, see how these democracies, they're not really functioning that well. And if you want America's democracy not function that well, to bring in somebody with Mr. Trump's unusual style, and if you see the kind of chaos and dysfunction that's happened since that time, I would argue if their goal was to further splinter America, get pretty good investment on the ruble side. You could almost have predicted some of this with General Gerasimov, I think, back in 2011, wrote the Russian military doctrine. He was their head of their Joint Chiefs of Staff, where he basically said Russia couldn't compete with the West in terms of tanks and guns and ships and planes, but in the realm of cyber and misinformation and disinformation, and he used the terms that spread like radiation, Russia could be the West's peer or even greater. And if you think about it from a holistic standpoint, we just passed a budget, $700 billion defense budget. Russia's defense budget's about $68 billion. I worry at times we're buying the world's best 20th century military when in many ways conflict in the 21st century may be in the realm of cyber and misinformation. And in those two areas, Russia is our peer.
In other words, you're saying too many aircraft carriers, not enough cyber intelligence expertise.
As a Virginia guy, I'd never say too many aircraft carriers, but I am saying maybe too much 20th century military when our systems are terribly vulnerable to cyber, when we've got this whole new realm of social media and misinformation, and we're still grappling with fake accounts. What happens when we move to 2018 technology where we put David Remnick's face on Mike Allen, another journalist's body, and you've got a suddenly live video stream of what appears to be David Remnick saying things that is not him at all? Think about that in the political realm, or think about that if it was a Federal Reserve chairman or a CEO. We're still catching technology, and I don't think we're fully prepared. And if you take the cyber domain, for the last, and this is not just a problem of Trump, this goes Trump, Obama, Bush, we've been afraid of cyber escalation for a decade plus, because if we escalate in the realm of cyber, we're more technologically dependent. And if our systems shut down, much more damage done than, say, if Moscow goes dark for 24 hours. So we've been reluctant to use a lot of those tools. And instead, we use them fine against Iran, North Korea, ISIS, small states. But near-peer adversaries like Russia and China, we've been reluctant to engage. And they have, from theft of our intellectual property to now intervening in our most core democratic process, our elections, they've not been as unwilling to use those tools.
I've read that you communicate over Signal, which is an encrypted app rather than just regular email or regular texting. Are you an outlier among your colleagues? Do other members of Congress also communicate on Signal?
Well, I don't always communicate on Signal. I go back and forth, but I frankly think I should probably improve my cyber hygiene. I do have dual authentication. I do try to make sure that I'm careful, because we're in an area, in a realm where whether it's having your information broken into, or whether it's having the data you give up willingly on social media, can be used and abused in ways that I don't think most folks would have predicted. And clearly, and I say this with some trepidation, a lot of my colleagues showed how little they understood social media when they interviewed Mr. Zuckerberg.
I think it was that point when Orrin Hatch wondered how Facebook made money that we kind of lost hope.
Not going there.
Now, Senator, you've got, and we all have, a problem of not partisanship, but just something much more extreme than that. If you were to type the words Russia investigation, say, into Twitter, you're confronted with two entirely alternate universes and reactions. Don't you worry that no matter what you find in your probe, a sizable portion of the country, maybe even approaching half, just won't believe it?
You're darn right. I am very worried about that. That's why I got to try to go the extra mile to keep this bipartisan. I got to believe there's enough Americans who, at the end of the day, if you've got joint agreement from both parties, people will start to accept it. And to your point about if you would have typed in Russian intervention on Google on Election Day in 2016, four out of the first five stories were not Fox News or CBS. They were of Russian origin. It was Sputnik, it was RT News, and it was a series of other Russian fronts that even on Google's algorithms, popped up at the top.
It's really
amazing.
That's
a pretty scary notion.
It's incredible. And no, and a related piece of business. It was just reported in our pages that aides of President Trump, possibly might have been aides, but we don't know who that was, someone hired an Israeli intelligence firm called Black Cube to investigate former Obama administration officials in the hopes of turning up something which would discredit the agreement. Is that kind of tactic consistent with anything you've learned in your Russia investigation, these kind of dirty tricks?
Well, again, we're not aware whether that is true or not. I've seen those same press reports. But it goes back, in my mind, to respect for rule of law. I think one of the most damaging outcomes of this whole episode is you got a whole lot of folks who are out basically in attacking the integrity of the whole FBI, attacking the integrity of the whole Justice Department, when you've got political figures threatening to fire an investigator like Mueller or Rosenstein, who are career officials, and in those two cases, both lifelong Republicans. That gets America into uncharted territory around respect for rule of law.
Forgive me, Senator. You're being polite in a sense. You're saying a whole lot of folks. You're saying various people. What you mean is President Trump. Do you think President Trump doesn't care a damn for rule of law?
I hope that is not the case.
But you think what?
I'm going to leave it. I've made my statements repeatedly that if, you know, it would cross a red line if he gets rid of the Mueller investigation or indirectly gets rid of it by getting rid of Rosenstein. You know, I hope and pray that doesn't come to pass. I think it would be a disaster for our country. But I'm going to, you know, I'm going to give my colleagues a chance, if God forbid that happens, for them then to make their decisions about how history is going to judge them.
Senator Warner, thank you so much.
David, thank you.
Senator Mark Warner of Virginia, the Vice Chairman of the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. More to come.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by the Sympathizer podcast from HBO. From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr., The Sympathizer is the new HBO original limited series based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel of the same name. On The Sympathizer podcast, join host Philip Nguyen in conversation with the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer, Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to The Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
Welcome back to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. Let's take a quick recap of the international news of the past week or so. The presidents of North Korea and South Korea had an unprecedented meeting. Donald Trump pulled out of the Iran nuclear deal. And we have a new Secretary of State, which is good since we may or may not be in a trade war with our partner and rival, China. If the headlines give you panic attacks, and maybe they should, think for a minute about the people who have to respond professionally to all of these developments in real time, hour by hour. The complexity of world events can't be easily modeled by some flow chart or an algorithm. So diplomats and policy analysts and senior military officials sometimes turn to unusual tools to understand how things may turn out. Here's contributor Simon Parkin, reporting from the UK.
There's a story from the Second World War that you probably haven't heard before. It's about U-boats. They were the Nazi submarine fleet, and they were causing a great deal of trouble for the British.
This is not a dressed-up propaganda story. It's telling you that this U-boat, one of the wolves that hunt in packs in the Atlantic, is as dangerous to your home as a 1,000-pound bomb from the air. There is no.
The Germans were using the U-boats to sink convoys of supplies en route to England at an alarming rate, sometimes hundreds each month. Winston Churchill came to believe that the outcome of the entire war rested on dealing with the U-boats. So he called up a retired naval captain named Gilbert Roberts. Roberts was a tactician, an outside-of-the-box thinker. And at a secret naval base in Liverpool, he came up with an unusual plan to help the Navy sink those U-boats.
Battleship! Battleship!
He designed
battleship.
A game.
It's loaded with action and suspense. Play it anytime.
Imagine a game of Battleship, but the board is the size of an entire room. One person plays the U-boat commander, and the other plays the convoy commander. They give their orders from the side of the room, and aides draw out the battle in chalk on the floor. Here's Major Tom Moat. He's an expert on war games.
The movements of the escorts and the convoy were done in white chalk, and the movements of the German submarines were done in brown chalk that was exactly the same colour as the wood, so that the escort commanders who were giving orders for their ships couldn't see where the submarines were.
A lot of the naval staff was out at sea commanding escorts, so the players in Robert's game were mainly new recruits to the Women's Royal Naval Service. These Wrens, as they were known, were mostly 18, 19 years old. Every day they played out different naval battle scenarios in Robert's game. After a few months, an admiral, one of the most successful submarine commanders of the First World War, in fact, went to Liverpool to see what progress, if any, Robert's group was making.
He said, "I'll have a go. I'll be the submarine commander and I'll play against the convoy." And he was sunk 6 times out of 6. So he said who was commanding the escort, and it was one of the 19-year-old Wrens.
Her name was Janet O'Kell, and she was actually 18. By playing this war game, she and the other women had come up with a strategy to sink German U-boats. And it worked.
Now, there's a moment there where, you know, the senior officer could get very crusty and very angry. But he didn't. He was like, "That's incredibly effective." That was then made in to naval instructions and radioed out to the convoys. And 2 hours later, they sank their first U-boat.
Before one could say, "Hail Hitler," the escorting warships closed in around their precious charges and proceeded to teach the Nazis a lesson.
It's a story that probably deserves a Spielberg movie, but it's not unique. For hundreds of years, war games have been powerful tools for military commanders and diplomats. Even today, they are played at the highest levels all around the world.
I've played Matrix games in the USA. I have played Matrix games in China. Haven't done it with the Russians. Don't think I'm going to get permission.
But Tom's games aren't about drawing lines on the floor. In the era of ISIS and fake news, you need a new kind of war game.
Matrix games are very simple games based on oral arguments.
And Major Tom is an expert on Matrix games. If what the Wrens were up to in Liverpool looked like Battleship, Tom's games looked like a cross between Risk, Dungeons and Dragons, and a rap battle. I visited Tom at the Defence Academy of the UK, where he teaches young officers how to wage international war on a tabletop.
Could you just tell me a little bit about, so we've got on the table a board about the size of a picnic blanket that's sort of got Ukraine at the top and goes all the way down to Egypt. Is this something you use in various...
In Tom's games, each player represents a country. You all sit around a map, and when it's your go, you say one thing that you'd like your country to do. A facilitator, which is kind of like what the military calls a dungeon master, asks the other players if they think that'll work.
Because, of course, the academic theory behind it is crowdsourcing the result.
There's a debate about whether you'll succeed, and if you can't all agree, well, That's where the dice come in.
We use, I tend to use casino dice, just in case, so they're properly balanced.
Tom takes dice very seriously.
Now, of course, some people go, oh, you're rolling dice, it's just a game of chance. Well, if you think that, then you don't understand risk. And if you don't understand risk, then perhaps you really ought to be in another job.
Major Tom's games have a simple framework, but they do allow players to bring an almost infinite amount of complexity to the table. You can do anything you can imagine, or at least anything you can make an argument for. That flexibility makes these war games very useful for untangling the complicated reasons why countries act the way they do. I talked to David Schlepak. He's an expert in wargaming at the RAND Corporation in Washington.
I've been at this for a very long time. I go back to the Cold War. And so we use them to look at global nuclear war and how you get into it and how you manage not to get into it. The major success for us is, do we move the needle on policy? Do folks take what they learn from the games and use it to change what they do when they go back to their day jobs? When we were first starting to imagine a world where North Korea had nuclear weapons. And so we set up a series of games where we asked the question, well, what would it mean for North Korea to have a small number of nuclear weapons? And we brought in a very senior player, a very smart man, a very good friend of mine, actually, who had done time in the Department of Defense as a senior policymaker. And he walked into the room at the start of the game and said, well, look, I don't understand why this is even a problem. They have 2, 3, 5 nuclear weapons. We have 1,500 nuclear weapons. I can do this math. And then we played the game. And he walked out of the room going, oh, holy Christmas, this is a gigantic problem. This changes everything.
So to see firsthand how wargaming can change your perspective, I sat in on a game Major Tom was running at the Defense Academy. It was kind of a big day in international relations. You may remember it.
The British Prime Minister Theresa May has explicitly blamed Russia for the poisoning of the former double agent Sergei Skripal and his daughter, and has expelled 23 Russian diplomats in response.
Come on in. No, we haven't actually started yet. So, who would you like to be with?
I'd like to be with Russia.
I thought you might. Grab a seat.
Straight off the picket line.
Like many people, I spent a fair bit of time worrying what Russia is up to. And this seemed like a pretty good way to get some insight. Now, for security reasons, all the players have to remain anonymous. But I can say that the guy playing Russia looked to me like a friendly university professor. He didn't much resemble Vladimir Putin, but he certainly had a talent for Putin's style of diplomacy.
Okay, Russia, what do you want to happen this turn?
I'm going to make a public televised announcement.
Yes.
Where we're basically going to indicate the UK is a third-rate power that is throwing a tantrum in order to sort of distract attention from its own political problems at home.
That idea was debated by the group.
Very few people believe Russia anymore, and they know, and they believe full well that it's just obfuscation.
Does anyone think that that's going to make the UK government look worse or better?
I think it's very arguable.
And the dice came out.
Oh. So, that was a 4. So, the way it would be interpreted in the game is that Putin's attempts to discredit Theresa May actually increase her standing in the rest of the eyes of the world. So, sadly, that one didn't work very well. Ukraine, what are you up to?
A setback. But it didn't discourage our Putin much. The next turn, he made a similarly gutsy move, offering to send humanitarian aid convoys to eastern Ukraine. Now, you may remember, that's the part of Ukraine that's sporadically under attack by Russia.
When I say humanitarian aid convoys, the urge to put air quotes around it is overpowered. Okay, now, Ukraine, will you accept these aid convoys?
Absolutely not. Yeah. Last time they sent aid convoys in, they were full of little green men that suddenly all had a Kalashnikov up their jumper.
Turn after turn, the other countries in the game tried to hem Russia in. The tactics they used were worryingly creative.
Also demand that the Russian ambassador attend the Secretary of State when we get a new one.
And taking Russia to the International Maritime Court of Arbitration.
We will conduct joint operational trials with the Queen.
Chechen sympathisers and separatists firebomb and attack Sochi naval base.
It could be easy to forget how complicated international relations are until someone gives you a seat in the Situation Room.
11! 11! Congratulations on a spectacular bit of diplomacy. I don't know who you got to run it, whether it was Bill Gates.
When the game is over, Tom asks everyone what their nation's goals were.
Okay, Russia, what were your objectives?
Well, the first one, you could take it one of two ways, one of three ways, is to ruin Britain's international reputation. That, on the face of it, went completely wrong.
Yeah,
but
yes.
Theresa May now has two choices. She's either strong enough to take Brexit forward, which means job done for us.
Yes.
Or she's strong enough to take hold of her own party and stop Brexit from happening, which means job down for us. One of those two things will happen. The second one was to basically maintain the position of our good ally Assad in Syria.
So basically, the Russians have managed to manipulate events to achieve their goals. Even with five extremely creative antagonists and some bad luck with the dice, Russia still kind of won. They controlled the game. This, Major Tom tells me, is not unusual. Outside the realm of professional sports, with their stratospheric salaries and primetime TV coverage, games are usually viewed as frivolous, something that should be set down after childhood, probably only picked up again in retirement. But those who work at the highest levels of defence and national security view games pretty differently. Here they are seen as perhaps the most efficient, tactile way in which theories can be tested and refined, and through which vital, potentially life-saving experience is gained. In war games, the actions of nations, armies and diplomats can be understood, maybe even predicted. And as warfare grows ever more complex, ever more frightening, the war games adapt, and the knowledge, the understanding they provide, could mean the difference between victory and defeat, even between war and peace.
Simon Parkin reports for The New Yorker on gaming and other subjects, and you can find his work at newyorker.com. Glenda Jackson has had an extraordinary and variegated career. One of Britain's most acclaimed actresses, she took a break from performing for more than 20 years to serve as a member of Parliament. She's back on Broadway now for the first time in a very long time, starring in a play by Edward Albee. I'll talk with her next week on the New Yorker Radio Hour. Before she was placed on the enemy's list of Saddam Hussein, which is a very dangerous place to have been, the poet Dunya Mikhail worked as a journalist for the Baghdad Observer. As the threats against her and many other journalists grew, Mikhail eventually decided to leave Iraq and came to the United States in 1996. She now teaches Arabic at Oakland University in Michigan. Mikhail writes in Arabic, English, and Aramaic, and she's written about war and its aftermath in a number of poetry collections.
Yesterday, I lost a country. I was in a hurry and didn't notice when it fell from me like a broken branch from a forgetful tree. Please, if anyone passes by and stumbles across it, perhaps in a suitcase.
Her new book, The Beekeeper, is a return to journalism. It tells of dozens of Yazidi women who survived kidnapping and sexual slavery by the Islamic State, which she calls by the Arabic term Daesh, and the man, a beekeeper, who helped arrange their escapes. Dunya Mikhail spoke with The New Yorker's executive editor and the host of our podcast, The Political Scene, Dorothy Wickenden.
The stories in the book come to you primarily through one man, a beekeeper named Abdullah, who has dedicated himself to helping Yazidi women escape from captivity. Tell me about him. What kind of man undertakes this kind of work, and how did you get to know him?
Yes, actually, I knew him by chance. I was trying to talk to some of these women to understand what's going on. I mean, I was just couldn't comprehend that this could happen in this time and the, you know, our time.
And you're in Michigan at this point.
Yes. So I was calling friends to, you know, just wondering what on earth is going on. Is that true? This is this not coming from fairy tales or something? But they were confirming this is what's happening. Everybody telling me what's happening to people they know. And I called even, you know, relatives. Anyways, but I tried to talk to some of these women who made it back. They escaped. And by chance, one of the calls, Abdullah answered the phone. And sometimes, you know, people in Sinjar, they don't know Arabic, so they answer in Kurdish language, so I couldn't understand. But Abdullah spoke in Arabic. So he said the person I was asking to talk to, her name was Nadia, was his cousin. But then she spoke in Kurdish, so he translated between us. When he translated between us and she was saying that Abdullah rescued her, I said, who is Abdullah? And she said, this is the man who's translating. Talking more and more with him, I learned that he was a beekeeper, that he left his bees and farm and everything there in Sinjar. And it all started on personal level. First, he was trying to find his own sister and his niece. And then even though he didn't find his niece, he was not feeling bad that he was just rescuing, you know, strangers. He was so positive. I liked how his behavior was. He told me, every time I save someone, I save my sister.
And I weep, he says. He tries to be there when they're reunited with his family. And he said each time, 70 times, he says he's gone through this.
Yes, but 70 times then. Now is over 350 times.
Hello?
Marhaba.
Hello, marhaba. Inna shlonik?
Alhamdulillah, shlonik enta?
Allah yakhliki, rabbi yahfazek.
Akusura hada zat iyaha elli biha.
Okay, could you tell us a little bit about what that conversation was about?
So he sometimes would send me his picture without explanation.
Yes.
So I would
which
get back
many
to
of which are in the book.
Yes.
Yes.
So I asked, so he said, this is Parveen. He said, do you remember Nadia? I said, yeah. And he said, okay, so when Nadia came, she told everyone that she saw that in the same place, house, there was a woman who couldn't talk or hear. And then everybody heard that. So her brother said, this must be my sister, Parveen.
So how does a typical rescue mission work? How does Abdullah, I remember at one point he describes his rescue operations as similar to his work as a beekeeper, and he talked about his hive. So how did he go about that?
Yes, that was so metaphorical for me, mm-hmm. when he mentioned it, how you need to be organized, you need to be careful, you need to do the plans step by step. Usually it starts with a call from the person, usually the woman. She calls somebody in her village, a relative.
And they're calling from the house where they are being held captive?
No. So each story is different. So, for example, some of them would find the nearest, if they see an internet cafe, where they ask to use the phone. And sometimes, you know, they don't have money, so they would ask if that's possible to do that. So now some of them, just in the street, a man is coming or a woman is coming and they say, can we use the phone? In those places, you don't know who is the friend, who's the enemy. It's so risky to do anything, to ask a person something. It's very risky. Yet, I mean, they did it. So then that person would call Abdullah, or maybe there are others like Abdullah. He would tell them, please don't tell them how are you and all that. Just take their, where are they? That's what we need to know. Just don't. So, and then he uses his, you know, his knowledge of the area that he knows, and he uses the Google map.
And he calls smugglers.
Then he called the smugglers, and they make a plan. The smugglers who used to smuggle cigarettes before, now they switch to, instead of cigarettes, and the same places that where they were storing the cigarettes, they bring women and have them stay there for a day or two. So there was an office that was opened after this Daesh invasion, there's an Office of Kidnapped Affairs. This was opened in response to, for example, people like Abdullah, who are doing it on personal level. So they wanted to kind of try to help. Sometimes they need to finance the smugglers and all their expenses and everything. Now, this office, they don't compensate right away. They wait until the person comes, the woman, let's say, and her children. After they arrive and give their testimony and their statement, then they're going to compensate whoever they borrowed the money from. But then Abdullah was saying, we can't wait. This is like urgent work. So they're still doing it their own way without waiting. And then later, he said, okay, compensation comes later. We're not going to wait for this.
And how does Abdullah make his living now?
So as a beekeeper, he was selling honey between Iraq and Syria. And that's how he was able to know those people in Syria that helped him in the first place, the merchants. And because this trade in our area is actually done different way than here. It's all done by loans. Mm-hmm. Maybe here it's more formal level, like credit. They don't have those types of banks and credit. They don't deal with that. It's all personal level. They trust this person. They would give the material later.
The two countries.
Yes, mm-hmm. Even between the two countries. Because of his reputation and the trust he built throughout the years with selling honey, that's how this helped him in this work, that trust that even with the rescuing of women, it's okay, you don't have money this moment, you're going to give us tomorrow.
The subtitle of your book, The Beekeeper, is Rescuing the Stolen Women of Iraq. And ISIS, or Daesh, as you call the jihadi group, has perpetrated so many atrocities in recent years that I wanted to ask you to explain its attacks on Yazidis in Sinjar. Why were they singled out for especially savage treatment in what became a genocide?
Yes. Well, first, when they attacked the area, all the non-Muslims, they call them non-believers. They labeled houses with the letter N for Nasara or non-believers. And first, it was them. But then the Christians, or who they call them Nasara, they were allowed to leave, even though empty-handed, because they call them people of the book, because they have the Bible. The Yazidis, they don't have a religious book, so to them they are infidels. So they thought that they could do whatever they want they wanted with them. So actually they killed men. They even buried some older women alive. They took women, younger women, female slaves or sex slaves, and their children also. They had them for service, and older boys, they had them for in a training camps. So they to them, this is spoils of war.
So the Iran-Iraq War began in the fall of 1980, and it triggered really most of the regional conflicts that we've all witnessed since then. You left in 1995. What did it feel like to watch the Iraq War and its aftermath starting in 2003 from the United States?
It looks like the war is, as I mentioned, it's growing with us. It grew with us. It survived with us. I mean, even after I left from afar, I still as if it's still there. And I feel like when I make these contacts with my friends back home, the war is so familiar that it is kind of ignored. I mean, it's so familiar. It's expected. It's part of life. It became part of life. Like a friend said, a bullet hit her shoulder, and she didn't care. She said, but it was by accident. It happened as if she was saying, today, by the way, I watched this or I read this. This bullet, I was just passing and came, I don't know from where. So it's like as if it's part of everyday life and people ignore it and laugh. I don't know.
Over the last year, Daesh has been effectively driven out of Iraq, but thousands of Yazidi women and children are still unaccounted for. Some are in captivity, some are dead. I think it's been 2 years since you visited Abdullah. So he assured you that the publication of the book wouldn't cause harm to him. But is that true? And also, how has he managed to avoid detection? How did he manage to avoid detection all of those years by Daesh?
Yeah, I mean, I was concerned about that. And he actually, he said, no, not only no, he said, I wish this be translated to other languages. I want as many people as possible to know what happened to us. Actually, he said his dream that this becomes a movie.
Well, and Abdullah is right, even though he didn't put it this way. This book is a story of heroism on so many parts, his obviously among them. I've got a book of your poems here, The War Works Hard. And you wrote those poems, as I understand, between 1985 and 2004. And I want to end by having you read, I think it's the first poem in this book. It's called Bag of Bones.
Yes, Bag of Bones. What good luck, she has found his bones. The skull is also in the bag in her hand, like all other bags in all other trembling hands. His bones, like thousands of bones in the mass graveyard. His skull, not like any other skull. Two eyes or holes with which he saw too much. Two ears with which he listened to music that told his own story. A nose that never knew clean air. A mouth open like a chasm. Was not like that when he kissed her, there, quietly, not in this place, noisy with skulls and bones and dust. Dug up with questions. What does it mean to die all this death in a place where the darkness plays all this silence? What does it mean to meet your loved ones now with all of these hollow places? To give back to your mother on the occasion of death a handful of bones she had given to you on the occasion of birth? To depart without death or birth certificates? Because the dictator does not give receipts when he takes your life. The dictator has a skull too, a huge one, not like any other skull. It solved by itself a math problem that multiplied the one death by millions to equal homeland. The dictator is the director of a great tragedy. He has an audience too, an audience that claps until the bones begin to rattle, the bones in the bags, the full bag finally in her hand, unlike her disappointed neighbor, who has not yet found her own.
The poet Dunya Mikhail speaking with The New Yorker's Dorothy Wickenden. Mikhail's new book is The Beekeeper. Just ahead, a walk around town with novelist Michael Cunningham, and Jack Handy explains the mysteries of humor. It's the New Yorker Radio Hour. Stick around.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs, because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. 30 years ago this summer, Michael Cunningham published his first piece of fiction in The New Yorker. Since then, he's published 6 novels, including The Hours, which won the Pulitzer Prize and was adapted into a film with Julianne Moore and Meryl Streep. He lives in Manhattan, and on a day with any kind of decent weather, you might find him taking in the hustle and bustle of Washington Square Park.
We're standing at the edge of the plaza, and there are hundreds of people here. You would think there was something going on. There is something going on, but the park is going on. And there's a performer over there, which I can tell by the fact that there's a huge crowd gathered around, but I can't tell who it is or what they're doing. All right. A man just jumped over 3 adult men and stick a perfect 10-point landing afterwards. And, you know, hey, for five bucks on a Saturday afternoon, it's not bad. I literally walk through the park at least once a day, sometimes 2 or 3 times a day. And as a writer, I live a work life of solitude. I sit in my studio and feel like a figment of my own imagination most of the day. And I will hit a wall, just lose it, just sort of lose track of what I'm doing and why I'm doing it and who are these people I'm trying to write about and why would I care about them. And that's an especially good time to go to Washington Square Park and be reminded that novels matter, books matter enormously, but there is a world that books, even the greatest of them, are merely a part of. So, get over it, Buster. No! Your people are sunbathing. People have brought out blankets.
No, honestly, bro.
Those boys are surely Mormons on a mission. There's a man in a Merlin hat. I think he does tarot. NYU is wrapped all around here, so there's plenty of kids from NYU. There was someone swimming in the fountain, but I think he may have. Oh no, I think there is someone swimming in the fountain. That's a regular occupation. Not by me. I don't swim in the fountain, but people do. There is a man actually throwing a baseball to his son. It's this sort of Blade Runner Norman Rockwell scene. It's a little insane and also just deeply American in that old-fashioned way. Pat, we're passing a little jazz combo. We're moving over to the western side of the park, which is just a little less populated. I'm very sorry to report that we've missed the annual Dachshund Parade, which was held today, as it is once a year, in Washington Square Park. And it is exactly what it sounds like. It's people walking their dachshunds through Washington Square Park. Excuse me, were you at the Dachshund Parade?
No, they don't do a parade. They just gather. It's gathering and we sing a song. There's no other dog like a dachshund walking so close to the ground. You're stubborn and sly as a fox and the happiest pet to be found. Doxy, minor Doxy, the best canine under the sun. Pull you wiener or sausage or hot dog. We know that you're number one.
That was dun, dun. Thank you.
Thank you for stopping.
Excellent song. That is so, so good. I've always felt that, okay, say an extraterrestrial appears before you and says, we're weeding out the galaxy.
and I don't have much time. Can you make a case for life on Earth? You could do worse than take that extraterrestrial to Washington Square Park and just say, all this life, all this rampancy, all this humanity. There are people singing opera. There's a dog run. There's everything you need to know about what it's like to be human is present within this small area. Spare it, okay? Planet Earth is really worth keeping around.
The novelist and short story writer, Michael Cunningham, in Washington Square Park in New York City. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. I'm going to leave you now in the good hands of Jack Handy. Handy has been writing for Saturday Night Live and The New Yorker for many years, and he created Deep Thoughts with Jack Handy so long ago that he titled his most recent book, Please Stop the Deep Thoughts. So here he is, Jack Handy, speaking about the mysteries of humor.
The mysteries of humor. Why is a man slipping on a banana peel funny, but not as funny as a man choking on a banana peel? Why is it boring when your friend Don tells you about his wife leaving him, but you laugh when you find out that she left him for another man named Don? When you see someone sinking in quicksand, is it funnier if you know the person? Are some things never funny, like a man accidentally chopping off his finger with a hatchet and wrapping up the finger and taking it to the hospital, then discovering that it isn't his finger, but one of the Vienna sausages he was having for lunch, and then eating the sausage? Can something be true and funny at the same time, like, your head looks like a melon? What is funnier, a dad trying to get his kid's kite up in the air, but getting it caught in a tree? Or a dad trying to get the kite down with a rake and accidentally tearing it to pieces? Will there ever come a time when we won't need laughter? When we'll be sitting on soft pillows, wearing our shimmering metallic robes, drinking our soothing space tea, and perhaps one of us will reach for a piece of cheese housed in an ancient device known as a mousetrap. And the mousetrap will snap on the person's finger, and he'll let out a yowl of pain, and the rest of us won't spit the tea out of our mouths, but will just stare blankly. Will that time ever come? Let us hope so.
That was Jack Handy with The Mysteries of Humor. His new book is called Please Stop the Deep Thoughts. The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Meryl Garbus of Tune Yards, with additional music by Alexis Quadrado. This episode was produced by Alex Barron, Emily Botine, Ave Carrillo, Rhiannon Corby, Jill Duboff, Karen Frillman, David Krasnow, Louis Mitchell, Sarah Nix, Mythili Rao, and Stephen Valentino, with help from Susan Morrison, Emma Allen, Corey Schreppel, Michelle Moses, Emily Mann, and Jessica Henderson. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing. Or
politics.
Country music.
Hockey.
Sex. Of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.